Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Matt Wood, director of FedSoc Films. This episode is all about our film, Retained by the People, The Ninth Amendment. The film features three prominent law professors, Professor Randy Barnett of Georgetown Law, Professor Michael McConnell of Stanford Law, and Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law. Professors Barnett and McConnell have been nice enough to join us for this FedSoc Films podcast to give us further insights into the film and also talk about where they may disagree on the case law surrounding the Ninth Amendment. Welcome to the show, and thanks for being on with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to play about 30 seconds from the film, Retained by the People, just to get things kicked off, and then we'll get into the episode.
From the very beginning, the whole point of the Ninth Amendment was to prevent the Bill of Rights from being a ceiling on the rights we have against the government. It's simply a floor.
Essentially, it's a hold harmless provision for unenumerated rights. It doesn't elevate them into constitutional rights, but it leaves them exactly as they were before.
The Ninth Amendment is the most important sentence in the whole Constitution.
The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights
shall not be construed to deny or disparage
others retained by the people.
Professor Barnett, you call it the Ninth Amendment the most important sentence in the Constitution. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I'm kidding on the straight there. It establishes or it reaffirms what I would consider to be the American theory of government that was initially formulated unanimously by Congress in the Declaration of Independence, which said, after talking about the individual and unalienable rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, it says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And the Ninth Amendment is an echo of that, because it speaks of the rights retained by the people. And by retained, it's a reference to rights they had prior to forming government, and that they continue to retain even after they form government. And in that sense, it is, in some sense, then, the most important sentence in the Constitution, because it restates or it echoes the political theory on which this country was founded.
Professor McConnell, do you think the Ninth Amendment shares that same status?
Randy and I are law nerds, and my guess is many of the people listening to this podcast are law nerds, too. We care about the history. We care about the philosophy. And from these points of view, the Ninth Amendment is certainly right up there, although I'd probably add a few others as well. As a practical legal matter for lawyers in court, though, the Ninth Amendment is not important. It has never really been the basis of a majority opinion in the Supreme Court. It's only been glancingly mentioned by the Supreme Court a couple of times over the 233 years of our history. And so it is fun for those of us who really care about the text and the history and philosophy, but as a matter of practical law, it is pretty much a dead letter.
And Professor Barnett, for those who haven't seen the film, would you mind giving a brief, if possible, overview of the court cases that you think are necessary to understanding the meaning and general case law around the Ninth Amendment?
Well, in this regard, I have to agree with Mike, and I'd be surprised if we disagree about many facts, and that is that there is no real case law that establishes the Ninth Amendment and its centrality per se. The case has been referred to by the Supreme Court, along with other provisions of the Constitution, but this is not one of the provisions of the Constitution that has big doctrinal significance, and you don't look to cases, you look to history to figure out what it means and why it's important. I do think the principle for which it stands behind much of modern doctrine. For example, it stands behind the fact that we have a government of limited and enumerated powers, and that the unenumerated powers, the ones that are implied by such clauses as the Necessary and Proper Clause, need to be interpreted in a constrained fashion because of the underlying principle that the Ninth Amendment articulates, not just implies, but actually articulates. So it has an indirect effect on constitutional doctrine, but This is not one of those provisions where there are key cases that you need to know in order to understand it.
What I really think the Ninth Amendment tells us is that a large part, maybe even the huge majority of the actual rights that we exercise in this culture, in this political society, actually have very little to do with the Constitution. We have so many rights that we exercise because of their rights that we have by nature. They may not even be mentioned in the Constitution. They may not be exercisable in law, that we may not go to court about them at all. But we are a free society for reasons that go well beyond what we can get enforced in law. And I think the Ninth Amendment does reinforce that we have any number of rights that we retain, and they were not disparaged by the creation of certain enforceable judicial, legal, constitutional rights. We still have them, and they are very important.
Professor Barnett, do you think that the cases that we talked about in the film, so Caroline, Lee Optical, Griswold, that those are important to understand because they are chips away at the Ninth Amendment, or instances where the Ninth Amendment lost some of its gravity or power?
Well, to the extent you privilege the enumerated rights because they're enumerated, that would seem to be a violation of the Ninth Amendment, which is cautioning that that is an inference and that is a rule of construction that you should not do. And I think that footnote 4 of Caroline Products does that. I think that Mike does that as well when he distinguishes, as he just did in his previous comment and he did in the film, between what he calls constitutional rights or legal rights and the background natural rights that we start with when we enter into government. I think it's that privileging of enumerated rights that is actually very, very modern. It wasn't actually until 1965 that an act of Congress was invalidated because it violated the First Amendment, the enumerated right of the First Amendment. So, to the extent you privilege one over the other, then that would be, I think that is against the Ninth Amendment, and which is why I would cite Caroline Products as that. And Williamson v. Lee Optical is important because it adopts what's called the rational basis test, but actually what that was an echoing of the rationality and arbitrariness review that preceded and was reaffirmed in the body of Caroline Products, which basically said that a law which was arbitrary and could be shown to be arbitrary would be a violation of the due process of law. That's what the body of the Caroline Products said. But by the time we get to Williamson v. Lee Optical, we find that any conceivable ground would be enough to justify government restrictions on liberty. And to the extent that some liberties are treated that way and other liberties are treated with greater deference, that would also be cautioned against by the rule of construction provided by the Ninth Amendment.
And Professor McConnell, what do you think about that?
Well, it all depends on what forum we're talking about for decision making, because there are, when we go to court with constitutional claims, what we are saying is that the decisions of the representatives of the people will be overturned. That's something that should only happen rarely. That is, we are a republic, and we vote for our representatives, and they think about these things. So Williamson versus Lee Optical is a very troubling case in lots of ways, because it's pretty obvious that special interests were dominating. This has to do with the regulation of the optician business. But, in truth, if you look at our democratic process, special interests play a huge role all of the time. And we don't, as a general rule, and shouldn't, in my personal opinion, ask the justices of the Supreme Court to be second-guessing the legislatures on questions of this sort. That, the details of regulation are often quite arbitrary, but we entrust those to the people that we vote for, not to folks who went to law school.
Well, that's cold comfort for individuals who are stuck with these laws, and it's unrealistic to expect them to get any remedy in the political process whatsoever. I mean, individual merchants, for example, business people who are engaged in hair braiding or casket making, or the provision of home health care. They're small and mom and pop stores, outfits. They're likely to get run over in the political process by larger, more entrenched economic interests. And I believe they have a right to that the, any restrictions on their liberty be justified. Now, the degree of deference you want to give to the legislature or whatever regulatory body, oftentimes dominated by the industries themselves, is really a separate question. But to give it unlimited deference, to say we're just going to close our eyes and be unrealistic about particular legislation, I think that's a mistake. And now, it doesn't mean you investigate the subjective intentions of legislators, because I think that's very difficult to ascertain. But the way it was done historically, through most of our history, has just been by examining the purported rationale, which we can, it doesn't seem unreasonable to ask the legislature to give us their rationale and not wait till litigation to do so, and the support for that, and then to evaluate it in some sense impartially when it comes under challenge. Let me give another example. Let me put this into Madison's terms. When he introduced the amendments to the Constitution, he had to respond to the argument that the federal government is one of limited and enumerated powers, and therefore putting amendments in is unnecessary. And he said, it is true that the powers of the general government are circumscribed, that they are directed to particular objects, but even if government keeps within those limits, it has certain discretionary powers with respect to the means, which may admit of abuse to a certain extent, which is why it was good to put restrictions in the Constitution. And then he added the Ninth Amendment because the restrictions he put in should not be construed as being exclusive. And then when it came time to evaluate the actual constitutionality of an actual measure by the Congress, which was the bank bill, in his argument for why the bank bill was unconstitutional, he read several, this is the report of his speech, he read several articles proposed, remarking particularly on the 11th and 12th, which was actually the 9th and 10th Amendments. The former, he said, as guarding against a latitude of interpretation, the latter as excluding every source of power not within the Constitution itself. So he argued that the 9th Amendment argued against a latitudinarian interpretation of the federal government's general powers to enforce, to exercise those objects or pursue those objects that were listed. And I think that's the perfectly appropriate role for the 9th Amendment, at least with respect to the federal government to which it initially applied.
So Madison did not offer the 9th Amendment in order to give courts more authority to hear cases based upon general principles of justice. It was an argument. He did it as a defense against the argument that we should not have a Bill of Rights at all. Because what his opponent, he was proposing things with, you know, like the First Amendment that protects very specific constitutional rights. And he was defending against the argument that, oh, if we protect certain particular rights, it's going to actually make us worse off because all the other rights that we exercise are going to be effectively repealed by the principle of you know, expressio unius. And so he said, we'll have the Ninth Amendment, which just holds them harmless. As, you know, whatever the other rights may be, they're going to be protected in the same way they always have been. And that's not a reason not to adopt the Bill of Rights. But there's no evidence that Madison thought that people would be able to raise the Ninth Amendment in court against regulations that they thought might be arbitrary. Now, I agree with Randy that the Ninth and Tenth Amendments also help us as a kind of principle of construction for the rest of the Constitution, not to either exaggerate the powers or to underplay rights that are have legal basis elsewhere. But, you know, the bank, for example, the argument there was not that the bank violated the Ninth Amendment. The argument was that the federal government, the Congress, was not enumerated any power to create the bank. And in this, I don't think, you know, Randy and I are probably not greatly in disagreement, or and maybe not at all, but Congress cannot enact any legislation which is not within one of the enumerated powers of Congress. Now, the same thing is not true at the state level. at least as a matter of federal constitutional law. As a matter of federal constitutional law, the states can do whatever they want under the 10th Amendment unless there's something in the federal constitution that precludes it. And so the Bill of Rights precludes certain, at least as through the medium of the 14th Amendment, precludes states from doing certain things like interfering with rights of property or free exercise of religion or freedom of speech and so forth. But there's nothing in the federal constitution that takes away or limits the power of state governments under their own constitutions to specifically enumerated activities. That's a principle of federal constitutional law that does not apply to state governments.
Of course, that's correct. Absolutely right. Again, I think it's unlikely for Mike and I to disagree about very much about the facts. But it's also true, and I'm sure he would agree with me, that the 14th Amendment limits the powers of state legislatures, including that part of the 14th Amendment that says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Now, the question is, are those privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States limited to the enumerated rights, rights that are enumerated in the text of the Constitution? And the doctrine that it is, or that really that the due process of law, when they switched to the due process of law, as Mike talks about in his path-breaking article in University of Virginia Law Review on Brown versus Board of Education, when they did the switch to due process, in neither case was it thought that it's the enumerated rights that are the only rights that privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. In fact, that incorporation doctrine, the doctrine that only the enumerated rights are incorporated, is a post-1940s developed Supreme Court doctrine. When the Supreme Court first started restricting state power, even to take property for public use without just compensation or because they infringed the freedom of speech, they asked whether those rights were fundamental. And in the case of the takings clause, they didn't even cite the Fifth Amendment when they first applied that principle to the states, because what was at issue is whether a principle or a right was so fundamental as to be a privilege or immunity of citizens of the United States. And then the fact that it was enumerated was evidence of its fundamentality, for sure, although it wasn't evidence cited by Justice Harlan in Chicago Burlington, the first case that recognized that right applying to the states. Yeah, sure. If it's enumerated, that's good evidence. But it's not the only evidence of the rights we have. There's other evidence as well of what rights are so fundamental that they're rights of citizenship.
Well, the first step in asking whether a right is fundamental is whether it's been one which is recognized in law. And so privileges, Randy, you know, rightly refers to the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which was originally the most important part of the 14th Amendment, but the leading precedent for what privileges and immunities meant, referring to the slight, to the a procedurally different but substantively identical set of rights, was from, I mean, they the authors repeatedly quoted from Corfield versus Coryell, and Corfield lists a number of rights, like the right to make and enforce contracts, to hold and bequeath and use property, to have the same criminal laws applicable, and so forth. But all of these were actual common law rights that were widely recognized among the states, and what the clause really did is it prevented sort of aberrant states, exceptional states, from departing from the established privileges and immunities that people had under the law. It did not mean that judges were able to ask themselves, well, do I think somebody ought to have this right? I mean, it's something like Roe versus Wade, and I'm not talking about the morality of abortion. People can argue about whether people ought to have abortion rights or not, but to go to the court and say, well, you know, abortion has in fact been illegal for hundreds of years, and people never had that right. But I think they should have that right because, in my opinion, and in the judge's opinion, it ought to be fundamental. This is a very different proposition. That isn't the way the framers of the Constitution thought. What they thought they were doing was protecting established legal rights that are well grounded in the common law tradition of the United States. It was the idea that you just go to court and make make arguments, normative arguments, based on what you think the law ought to be, has no relation to the Ninth Amendment, to the Privileges and Immunities Clause, to the Due Process Clause, or to any other part of the Constitution.
And I agree 100%, putting Roe to one side, I agree 100% with everything that Mike just said. I think it was what would separate both Mike and myself from Larry Tribe, who was in the video. I agree entirely with that. In fact, I have a book coming out next year called The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment. It's letter and spirit. And when we ask for what rule of construction would be the best way of identifying privileges or immunities, we do have to look at the privileges. What are the privileges or immunities? Not what they ought to be, but what are they? And you have to look back in, at prior periods to identify these privileges or immunities, and which, by the way, can include more than natural rights, more than the rights retained by the people, can become privileges or immunities over time as recognized in positive law, as Mike said. So it's a broader category than the Ninth Amendment, to bring us back to the Ninth Amendment. But the Ninth Amendment also refers to retained rights, which are well known and which have been identified, and the contours of which have been specified in common law. And the language that Mike just cited in Corfield really was copied almost word for word. The core of that language is copied almost word for word from George Mason's Declaration of Rights that he wrote for the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which had that very same language in it, which was adopted by at least four other states in their state constitutions, and which identify expressly, really identify what the what the retained natural rights of the people are, and which figure into the interpretation of the limits of state. Of the state, the general powers of the states, or the necessary and proper clause, discretionary powers of Congress to enforce, to pursue one of its enumerated objects or ends so we agree about the facts, and we agree not only about the facts, but we agree that this does not empower judges to make up what ought to be rights, what ought to be fundamental rights in the opinion of the judges. But it does mean that where we do disagree, and we continue to disagree, is about whether there is this separate elevated category called constitutional rights. And they're separate and elevated because they were the ones put into the text of the Constitution. And they, and only they, are rights to which judges should pay attention when construing either the police powers of states on the one hand under the 14th Amendment, or the federal powers under the enumerated powers plus the necessary and proper clause when taking into account the injunction they are given by the Ninth Amendment.
That is an absolutely fascinating discussion, and I'm so glad we got to get into that. Professor McConnell, I'd like to see if you have any closing thoughts on the Ninth Amendment, or anything that you think that we should have covered in the film but we didn't, or any resources that you would point our listeners to.
So I think Randy and I may agree more than I had realized. The great gulf in constitutional law is between those who believe that the courts are a kind of super legislature. So you go to them when you think that things aren't right. You go to them when you want the law to be different than what it is. And our Constitution is actually quite backward. Looking. It protects the legal rights that people actually have. And so the Ninth Amendment refers to the rights retained by the people. Well, you can't retain something unless you had it before. And so it means you still have it, right? You retain it, but it doesn't empower the courts to sort of make up new rights. The Due Process Clause refers to depriving people of their rights of life, liberty, and property. So these are rights that they had recognized in law before. The privileges and immunities are the established rights that people had as American citizens. And so I think this is the very big difference. Now, you know, perhaps Randy and I have some a nuance of disagreement about, you know, what to do when people are you know, arguing outside the realm of enumerated rights. But I think the most important thing that's come out of this conversation is that both of us reject this kind of very modern living constitution view that the judges are there to simply to make things up on the basis of what they think would be a juster society.
And Professor Barnett, same question to you.
I would say this is a breakthrough podcast because I've been trying to get Mike to appreciate for years what I'm actually saying about the Ninth Amendment and what I've always said about the Ninth Amendment, dating back to the 1980s. It's not that I haven't refined my views a bit. I have, but I've by and large been saying the same thing for quite a long time, and we have been in a greater agreement than he realized. And so this is a breakthrough podcast. In terms of what I would think readers to take a look at, I would ask them to take a look at my 2006 Texas Law Review article that says the Ninth Amendment, it means what it says. And you don't have to look that hard for it. You can look on randybarnett.com and look at and click down the menus for post-2000 articles, and you'll find a free link to that from the Georgetown website. And then in that article, I examine the five competing models of what the Ninth Amendment has been said to mean. And I evaluate every piece of evidence that we now are aware of, at least that we were aware of in 2006, and see how that evidence lines up with the competing models of the Ninth Amendment. But I still want to go back to this point of agreement. What's at issue with respect to background rights? And also it's what's at issue with respect to enumerated rights, because I don't want to distinguish between one and the other, is how you construe the scope of government power, how you construe the necessary and proper clause, which is invoked to implement an enumerated power, and how you construe the more general power, only because it's not limited to particular objects, of state governments. And we agree about a great deal. I know of few places where we disagree, but by and large, there's more agreement than disagreement between us.
Well, thank you both, Professor McConnell and Professor Barnett, for spending more time with us on this subject. It truly has been fascinating, and we always appreciate your insights.
It was great to be a part of this project.
Thank you.
You can check out the film Retained by the People on YouTube, Facebook, or fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.